Welcome to the Denver Community Church Teaching Podcast. We're so glad that you're joining us today from wherever you are. Whether you attend one of our Denver locations or listen online, our hope is to explore and participate in the life of Jesus so that we can be a healing presence in our world. As you listen to this teaching, allow it to begin a conversation between you and God, you and the Bible, and you and your community. If you have any questions about DCC or this teaching, you can email us at info@denverchurch.org. And if you'd like to financially support our community and beyond as we set aside 20% of every dollar given to support our partners locally and around the globe, you can text the words Denver Church to 77977. That's Denver Church to 77977. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey friends, it's good to be with you all online. Wherever you are as you engage this gathering, I pray you're well. We're in the third week of Advent, and Advent is not my favorite time of the year. I mean, don't get me wrong. I enjoy the anticipation of Christmas and all the things that come with it. But the calling of Advent, the true meaning of this season, is meant to be a time of waiting. It's supposed to be a time that we pause and sit with our pain and our longing and focus on the hope of Christ. Now, this is hard for me normally, but this year, I'd like to suggest that we've all done our fair share of waiting, haven't we? You know, between COVID and the recent election, I've paid pretty close attention to the news, and I've been anxious for some good news. And I've heard my friends' hot take on the news, and even their friends' hot take on their take on the news, and I'm tired. I'm tired of waiting, tired of uncertainty. And honestly, I'm tired of being tired. And I know you are too. And I think we're all desperate in one way or another for some hope. So, as a part of this teaching, I want to share a story. It's not a very well-known story, but it's a story from Scripture about a man who is desperate for some hope. You can find the story in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 5. Once you get there, let's look at verse 1. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now it's important to know that Aram was a neighboring country to the people of Israel. And we're told that this man Naaman had leprosy. We're not told what sort of skin disease this was, but we know it was a disease of the skin. And in his day and time, it's important for us to understand that he was desperate because having such a diagnosis was a death sentence. Naaman is desperate for his life. Let's look at verse 2. Now, bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, Naaman's wife, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman, having heard of this, went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read this: "With this letter, I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." Now, what I've come to really enjoy about the scripture is that these seemingly small and random details are usually really important for understanding the text. In his concern for Naaman, the king of Aram is going to write a letter and send a bunch of money to the king of Israel. In fact, he sends the equivalent of 700 pounds of silver and 150 pounds of gold. Then, notice in his letter that he requests that the king of Israel himself cure Naaman of his disease. He's told by Naaman of a prophet, but the king, doing the politicking he knows to do, he wants to flatter the king by addressing him in this way. Do you see what's happening? As a very wealthy and politically adept leader, he's practicing his best diplomacy. He's leveraging his power and wealth in the best way that he knows how to get the results that he desires. Let's look at verse 7. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent this message: "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elijah's house. Note again the details here. Naaman comes with all his gold and silver and horses and chariots and all his royal importance, but the king of Israel, insecure in his own pride, takes the request as a political insult, as a challenge, and he sends Naaman away. But Elijah intervenes and asks the king to have Naaman come to his house. Now, can you imagine all the prestigious horses and chariots? They leave the king's palace and pull up to the humble home of this prophet Elijah. You also here begin to get the sense that Elijah is not very concerned about catering to anyone's entitlement or sense of importance. Verse 10. Elisha sent a messenger to Naaman saying, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the river, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abban and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and went off in a rage. So Elijah doesn't even get up from the couch. Instead, he sends a messenger, and Naaman is not having it, not one bit. He's like, "What? This prophet can't even come and talk to me face to face? He can't see me in person? I expected him to come before me in person because I'm Naaman, a great general. Where's the magic show? Where's the great healing? He just wants me to go down to that dirty river? We have much more majestic rivers back in Aram. No, thank you." By the way, there's nothing impressive about the Jordan River. I know all the miracles took place there, and it has a sentimental place in us for those with hindsight. But the reality is, it's a knee-deep, dirty creek. Think Clear Creek in Golden. Look at verse 13. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" So here's what's happening. Notice again, the servants are trying to appeal to the general with some expediency here. Though their appeal is likely not very appropriate, "Here we've come all this way. What do you have to lose, sir?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times. As the man of God had told him to do. And his flesh was restored, and he became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "I know that there's no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant." The prophet answered, "As surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing." And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. You see, Naaman has now been transformed. He got his miracle, but his miracle did not come in the way that he expected. And he's still trying to play the game that he knows so well. But it is now Elijah who will have none of it. Elijah refuses to accept the lavish gift, and you'd think this might be a turning point for Naaman, but instead, we see the graciousness of God go further. Verse 17, "If you will not," said Naaman, "please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord." Naaman wants to carry away the dirt back to his homeland of Aram. And it's kind of a weird request, right? Like, you might seem quite odd. But in the ancient world, people connected location with spirituality in a way that we do not in the modern world. For them, location itself has greater spiritual significance, and therefore it's as if God had a zip code. There was geographical boundaries for each deity. Because Elijah would refuse the lavish gift that Naaman wanted to give him, Naaman requests that he be able to take some dirt back to Aram so that he could make his sacrifices and take upon this special holy dirt. In this, he would be worshiping and paying homage to God, the God of Israel. Now remember, the details are important here. It's remarkable that Naaman had a change of heart, but we're given a curious detail. He asked to take as much dirt as 2 mules can carry. Now, ancient Near Eastern scholars make note that a large and healthy mule, surely the sort that Naaman would have brought with him, could carry as much as 450 pounds each, which means that 2 mules, Naaman would have carried around 900 pounds of dirt, which is about how much gold and silver he brought to purchase his healing. Do you see the contrast and the irony? The God of Israel cannot be bought. He can only be received. Now, the story gets only a little bit more peculiar. Let's look at verse 18. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Ramon to bow down, and he's leaning on my arm, and I have to bow there also. When I bow down in the temple of Ramon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this. What in the world is going on here? All right, we're given this little anecdote at the end. Naaman's about to leave, and he has this one remaining question. He's like, hey, real quick, by the way, when I go back to Aram, the king and I are like pretty tight. Like I'm kind of his right-hand man. And so each day, he goes to the temple to worship our God, this guy named Ramon. So he likes me to be at his side. And when he goes to the altar, he's going to want to bow. And now, I would never bow to Ramon, of course, but I will be holding his hand. And so in order to do so, I will need to bow with him. But it won't just be to like help him, of course. I would never really worship Ramon. But like, if I do that, is it okay? This little tidbit is fantastic. Like a politician who says, okay, I smoked marijuana, but I never inhaled. Or someone who says that they were praying, but then they fell asleep, so that they were like napping and praying at the same time. Is that okay? And what is Naaman's response here? He says, my friend, go in peace. Do you see what's happening? All of the wealthy, powerful, and important people in the story, Naaman, the kings, are all caught up in their wealth, their importance, their diplomacy, their attention to boundaries and customs and formalities and law, and the fear of skirting heresy. But they get it all wrong. But who saves the day and ultimately acts wisely and ushers in transformation? A little slave girl, a couple lowly servants, and a renegade prophet. The God who lavishes his grace, which you can't buy, earn, or hustle, you can only receive. This is the story of Naaman, and it's outlandish. In fact, it's almost as outlandish and ridiculous as Christmas. You know, we might read this story about Naaman and think, how ridiculous. Can't this Naaman see the terrible irony? He came with 900 pounds of gold and silver, and he goes home healed, hauling 900 pounds of dirt. And yet, like every good prophet, this story points squarely to Christ himself. The story of Christmas is no different. Christmas is about God, who is Emmanuel, who is with us. This is the scandal of Christmas. Jesus came to us as a brown-skinned Jew, born into a nearly single mom, who left her homeland as a refugee in order to flee genocide, only to return to the lowly town of Bethlehem with no proper home to give birth. And so she's consigned to a dirty shack for animals. And Jesus' first nap after his birth was in a feeding trough, where he was visited by foreign magicians and common shepherds who could somehow see what everyone else had missed. God had come to do something new in our midst by bringing peace and good news that would confound rulers and religious leaders alike. And today, we continue to miss the scandalous message of the incarnation by dressing it up in all sorts of commodities and lavish gifts and domesticated sentiments. But maybe this year could be different. If there was ever a year that we really needed a more honest and authentic Christmas, perhaps 2020 is it. A Christmas that cuts through the clutter, the commerce, and our normal assumptions about God, and instead embrace the Christ who cannot be bought, negotiated, or earned, but who can only be received. A God who has no boundaries. A God who is truly with us, all of us. Let it be so, my friends.